Casey Must. I'm the owner and founder of Citizen Yoga, and you are listening to After Class. After Class is our podcast where we further our mission for preventing suicide, increasing awareness around mental health, and bringing the practice of yoga to as many people as we can. Often we interview our students, our teachers, our community members, and today I am so grateful. Beyond grateful, I think I sing her praises far and wide to have Dr. Gail Parker as our guest today. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's good to see you. It's a dream. It's a dream to have you. And I think everybody knows who hears me talk about you that we admire your work. I admire your work and everything that you've done so far.
Well, I think it's a mutual admiration society because, as you know, I admire all of the work that you do and always have. And I miss Citizen Yoga as my home studio because I don't live there anymore.
I know. I was so sad.
I'm not sad about that.
I know.
A lot.
So let me tell our listeners a little bit about, Dr. Gail. Or Dr. Parker or Gail, but Dr. Gail for today. She's an author, a psychologist, a yoga therapist, educator, a lifelong practitioner of the practice. And she's currently the president of Black Yoga Teachers Alliance, the board of directors. And she's well known for pioneering efforts to blend psychology, yoga, meditation as effective self-care strategies that can enhance emotional balance and contribute to overall health and well-being. I will say, before I finish reading her little biography in a very formal way, that your work has done that for our teacher training programs. Your work has done that for me personally. So it's not just a nice biography, which it is a nice biography, but your efforts to blend psychology, yoga, meditation has really brought so much light and awareness to so many people who have read your book. So thank you for that.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
I'd like that to be part of our conversation too, if we have time, because it's always helpful to me to know the impact I'm having. And I think that all of us, I spend a lot of my focus is on self-study, the concept of, in yoga, svadhyaya, we call it, but really developing, cultivating that, cultivating our mind as a tool of awareness, not just a storehouse of information, so that we can become self-reflective and pay attention to how we're impacting other people and knowing how other people are impacting us. So I'm hoping we can talk about that.
Yes. That's on my, we have a long list. I have, I was up at 5 a.m. writing all of my notes for how many questions I had to ask you. I'm going to just finish to just tell you and reinforce that Dr. Gail, she's a faculty member at the Kripalu School of Integrative Yoga Therapy and has appeared numerous times as a psychologist expert on nationally syndicated talk shows, including Oprah, which Anne Fancy would be so thrilled to hear that fact. and then, again, we were talking about your book. And for those that are listening, Dr. Parker's, I've known Dr. Gail, I'm going to keep going back and forth between all the names that I'm going to call you today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yep. But before you launched your book, you and I have had many conversations, and I've known Dr. Parker my long time since I was a child practicing and sort of, we've run in the Detroit yoga scene together, even though I was a child and had no idea what was going on. but this book took the conversations that I think you were trying to have with me a while ago when I first opened Citizen and brought it to light what you were really trying to say to me. So for those that are listening and you maybe haven't bought this book or you haven't done our teacher training, please go out and buy this book. The book that Dr. Parker published is called Restorative Yoga for Ethnic and Race-Based Stress and Trauma. And I have 1,000 quotes that I would like to talk about from your book today. So we don't even need to. We will talk about what it mentions. But if you could summarize in some way, what was the initiator of publishing this book? How did you take all this knowledge that you've had and all the things that you've witnessed? How did you compile that and distill it down to this very compelling work?
Wow, that's a big question. And yeah, so do you mind if I give kind of a long answer?
Yes, I would love a long answer.
Okay, so for years, you know, I was a practicing psychologist for many, many years. And I've also been a lifelong practitioner of yoga. And many years ago, it occurred to me that yoga was an important part of the work that I was doing just to help people cultivate, again, that awareness of their bodies, of their minds, of their spirit, that there really is no separation here, even though we like to think there is. And so while I didn't teach yoga, I took yoga teacher training so I could learn more about what I was practicing, really. And so I did teach for about a year. I taught restorative yoga for a year and fell in love with it and realized this is a perfect way to support people in coming into their awareness of self in a new way, in not just a cognitive way, not just talking about it way. And then I began to sort of integrate all of that, the philosophy of yoga, the contemplative aspects of yoga, the meditative aspects, into my practice and into my teaching, because people are not coming to a psychologist to learn
right.
yoga asana. So I wasn't doing that part. And so over the years, my clients would say to me, you need to write a book. And I would always say, I don't have a book to write. Dr. Parker, you need to write a book. I don't have a book to write. So one time a client said to me, she was terminating therapy. She said, I tell you what, she said, first of all, the book is already written. That resonated. I thought, whoa, I mean, that sounds like something I would say to someone. The book is already written, she said. I'll hold a space for you until it manifests. That woman sent me a birthday card I didn't know she knew my birthday. Every year I got this birthday card for years saying, I'm still holding the space. When are you going to write the book?
Wow.
So then one day I said, well, if I ever write a book, I will never self-publish. The only way I'll write a book is if a publisher approaches me. I said those words. And of course, when does that happen? You know what I mean? Why would a publisher approach me? Well, one day while minding my own business, I was a member of the I'm having a brain freeze. The International Association of Yoga Therapists.
Yeah, that's a long one.
My book title is a long one, you know. But anyway, so I was a member of that group, and the CEO saw my resume and said, and on the resume I said that I had an interest in supporting using yoga and meditation to support emotional health and well-being, and a particular interest in utilizing restorative yoga to deal with issues of race and ethnicity, because around 2015, it became very clear to me that, wait a minute, in the yoga world have an opportunity to make a huge difference here. If we in the yoga world, meaning which is a predominantly white world, can get that we're all impacted by issues of race and ethnicity, whether we know it or not, whether we like it or not. And we all have something to learn, and we all have something to teach and share with each other. So he saw this and he said, would you be willing to make a presentation at our conference? So I wrote a proposal and it was accepted. I was afraid to do it again, because it's a very tender topic for me. And presenting to a predominantly white group was, as a black woman, was, I had to think about it. I had to think about, do I want to, can I make myself this vulnerable?
Yeah.
Well, it's what I teach. So I said, okay, I guess I have to.
So you want to be your own client for a second.
I do. Yeah. And like my own clients roll their eyes when I tell them what to do because they don't like it. I don't like it either when I tell myself what to do.
Yes.
They're mad at me. Anyway, so I made the presentation. It was so well received that he called me later and said, next year we want you to be a plenary speaker. Don't write a proposal, just come and do the speech. So again, I said, it's how many, what's the racial demographic? He said it's a 95% white organization, which I kind of knew, but I thought, oh boy, how am I going to talk about issues of race and ethnicity to a 95% white organization without setting off all kinds of emotional negativity reactions, et cetera. So I called this topic. It was one of the best presentations I've ever made, by the way.
I think you told me about this one. Yeah.
I called it White is a Color Too.
Oh, I love that.
And I gave it in a TED Talk kind of presentation. So it was about a 20-minute talk. And I just went through what I thought was important for white people to know about race and ethnicity, which includes white people too, not just other, not just people of so-called people of color, which is a term, by the way, that is very annoying to me, but all of it is.
This is why I like you on a podcast, because then I get to hear your opinion.
Yeah. So anyway, I made this presentation. And can I tell you the story how I ended it?
Yes.
It was a great ending. What I wove throughout the presentation was, first I said, hold the back of your hand up and take a look at it and tell me what color you see. Because I know that like if you did it right now, what color do you see when you look at the back of your hand?
Like a beige.
Okay. And I would say that I'm caramel color. Yeah, I mean, that's.
Yeah, like I'm beige. Sometimes I'm like green. Okay. Like olive-y. Okay.
However, what you don't see is white, right?
Right.
What you don't see is black, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Red or yellow. Those were all the color designations I know, it's so sad. So,
yeah. Welcome to our world.
So I said all of that. And then I went on to talk about how important it is for us to shift the paradigms. And to stop saying that we're colorblind, and to because we aren't,
right?
No, we're not. You know,
right?
And to stop saying that having this conversation is divisive, because it isn't.
Yeah.
You know, and so let me end it with the thing. Go ahead. You have a question. Then I'm
No. I was moving something. No, I don't have a question.
All right.
I mean, I have millions of questions, but yes.
Okay. Let me tell you how I love this. This is so. Here was the ending. A friend of mine who happens to be a very dark-skinned black woman told me this story. I said, can I use it in this talk? She said, absolutely. Here it goes. When her son was about 6 years old, he came to her. He said, Mommy, what color am I? She said, what color do you think you are? He said, I don't know. She said, well, go get your crayon box, and we'll see if we can find your color. So he ran and got his little crayon box of 8 colors, and he couldn't find his color. So she said, well, go get your 64-color crayon box, and we'll see if we can find it. He looked and looked and looked and looked and looked. Finally, he found his color. He pulls the crayon out. He says, Mommy, I think I'm this color. What color is this? She said, that's apricot. He said, so I'm apricot? She said, is that the color you see? He said, yes. She said, then that's the color. Well, what color are you? He wanted to know. She said, what color do you think I am? He looks and looks and looks. He pulls out, what was that? The auburn, you know, that auburn color. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Burnt sienna. That wasn't quite right. He put it back. He found dark brown. He pulls it out. He said, I think you're this color. What color? She said, that's dark brown. He said, so you're dark brown? She said, is that the color you see? He said, that's the color I see. She said, then that's it. So a couple of weeks later, she's picking him up from school. His little white classmate jumps in the back seat of the car and says, how come you're black and you're white and your mommy's black? And he said, I'm not white. I'm apricot. He's not black. She's dark brown. And besides, there's only one white person in the whole wide world, and his name is Michael Jackson.
That's amazing.
I love that story. So after this present, I got a standing ovation. Everybody laughed. You know, I got the standing ovation. Because one of the things, one of the gifts I know I have is, and I know to have this conversation in a way that is constructive. Mm-hmm. I don't have it in a way that is not. It doesn't mean that people don't get set off, because sometimes they do. But I really do know how to create a very safe environment for having the conversation, so that if somebody does get set off, we can manage that. So a publisher approaches me 5 minutes after this talk and says, I heard your talk. You need to write a book. I said, a book? She said, yes. I said, it's a 20-minute talk. She said, no, it's a book. So I almost didn't do it, because remember, for years I've been saying, I don't have a book to write. I don't have a book to write. That voice came up again. And I thought, you know what? I said to myself, I took myself by the collar of my shirt and I said, write the book. So I did. And what I discovered in writing the book is what everybody, many people who write say, that the hardest part about writing a book is confronting your own self. Because you have, again, once again, am I willing to make myself vulnerable enough?
Right.
To share from the deepest parts of my being. And so I wrote the book with that intention, so that it is not just, because see, I don't think that issues of race and ethnicity are just about black and brown people. I think they're about white people too. So I wrote it in a way that I think they're just universal principles.
Right.
That we all need
that's
the thing. And that's not about skipping over anything. Go ahead. I'll stop talking now.
I think that what you're saying is, there's two questions I have, which is what in the presentation or in the book makes you feel vulnerable? Like, what about sharing your perspective, your point of view feels vulnerable?
All of it, because my deepest wound, this is what I believe. It's more than a belief, it's a knowing. All of us have been wounded in some way, emotionally, in some way. And as a psychologist, what I know is that original wound is the most important one. And that all of the other emotional eruptions or hurts that we experience center around that original hurt that never had an opportunity to heal over. So for me, because I was exposed to racism as a child growing up, it's very painful to me.
Yes.
And so I don't want people to dismiss what I think is important. And I don't want people to comment in a way that would be hurtful to me about issues of race and ethnicity, all right? So that's what makes me feel vulnerable. But that's because it's my wound. Right. And I think my first chapter, I think I call it the wounds heal, but the scars hurt.
Yeah.
And then I tell stories about being in yoga environments, not just, you know, where people have said some fairly outrageous things it has been important to address them, which I have.
Yeah.
But it's not always easy to do. So I don't want to be dismissed. I think I don't want to be treated as if what I'm saying has no value.
So how do you identify that wound? Like, I was thinking about, I was actually reading your book this morning. So we study your book often in the philosophy class that I teach. And one of the, there was a section that you were writing about. I actually probably wrote it down. It's probably like, let me see where it is. But the point that you're really in this part of the book that you are making is that before you address something, you have to make sure that you're not being reactive to it, that around page 78, you said reactive, reflexive, and defensive responses are indications of some sort of pain and suffering of your own mm-hmm. that you might not be aware of. Mm-hmm. And that, see, the thing that I love about this book is there is just so much yogic philosophy in every single statement. I could highlight the whole thing. So I was thinking for myself, I had a conversation yesterday when I was explaining this new business concept I'm working on. And I found myself in the moment becoming reactive to a very mild confrontation, very mild, very like, just like, well, why don't you have this in your space? Why didn't you choose to have, it was actually about daycare. Why don't you have daycare in this new postpartum space? And I like found my reaction so like, whoa, why am I being like that? And when I was reading that at 5 a.m. this morning, I'm like, okay, there's something about my fear of failure or my fear of like that came up while I'm launching this new concept because people don't believe in what we're doing or like, you know, physical spaces are hard. And so I hear this all the time and it makes me defensive. And so that wound for me personally is definitely around like achievement, failure. Am I strong enough, courageous enough, brave enough to do these kinds of things? Mm-hmm. So a lot of my life is a reaction to that. But how, that's my own, I've done a lot of therapy and a lot of work on that, but how would somebody that's listening identify, besides going to therapy, any tools to like, what, how do you find that original wound?
Well, it takes a lifetime, really. Yeah, it just does. And so for me in writing this book, I had to go deeper and deeper and deeper into aspects of self that I think I've already done all of that. Everybody thinks I've done that already, you know? So yeah,
you did
that, but you didn't do this, you know, and there's always more. So the invitation, so yoga, for me, the invitation in our yoga practice is always to go deep.
Yes.
Just to keep going deeper and deeper into the exploration. So since you brought yourself up, let's use that as an example. So, I'm always learning as I'm, every time I have one of these conversations, every time I do a webinar, I'm learning something new about all of this, myself and the topic as well. What I'm beginning to get real clear about, because I used to call the emotional reactivity, I used to call it triggers. We all did, you know, when you get triggered. But what I realize now, what I'm beginning to realize is, wait a minute. It's more, so something happens that causes a big reaction. You had a big reaction to what would appear to be on the surface a minor event. Well, why didn't you put a daycare in? And instead of saying, oh, you know, I never thought of it, or that's a great idea, or something like that, or whatever that is, you have this big reaction. You notice that you're getting really, really, really defensive.
Yeah.
This is what I know is happening. You're remembering something. You're remembering something, not in your head, but there is something inside of you that is recalling something that has occurred that was painful to you.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're defensive, what we're doing is we're contracting around the pain. And in yoga, we call those samskaras. Those are the samskaras. That's the stuff that we never were able to process for whatever reason that stays stuck in the body.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying? So it's not a cognitive process, but it's a yoga. We teach that.
Right.
You're remembering, reconnecting with aspects of being that have been clouded by all of the socialization we've been through, the defensiveness that we construct to keep from being hurt.
Yeah.
And so I would say to people that when you notice, this is the way I teach it. I'm going to see if I still believe this, because I'm pretty sure I do. So whenever you have a big reaction to any of it, but especially a small, what appears to be a fairly, you know, benign,
small.
Yeah. Yeah. But it wasn't. So you had this great big old reaction to it. It's always, whenever one gets triggered, I'll use the language, it's 90% the other person, 90% you, 10% the other person or the event. It's not that what the person said or did didn't hurt you, it did. But your response is your response. And that's what you always want to get curious. Wait a minute, how come? You may not know the answer right now.
Right.
So we keep asking the question, what was that? What did that open up in me that I have not been aware of? What wants to move through me so I can let it go?
Yeah.
So in this culture, as you know, conversations around race and ethnicity have been taboo. People don't like to have those.
Right.
People don't think that we should be having those. There's a research article that keeps popping up in my feed it's titled something like, race wouldn't be a problem if we just stopped talking about it. It's that. And we're seeing that in the culture, books are being banned, speech is being censored. That's the solution. Just don't talk about it because it's painful. And I say, well, there's the pain of healing, which is temporary.
Mm-hmm.
And the pain of contraction, which causes more problems.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a choice. You can stay in contraction or you can go through the pain of it's not even letting go, of letting something be, letting it be.
There was a quote you used that I found some morning and probably have drilled it into people's brains now. It was the Edward Bruce Bynum quote that you use, which says, "Wisdom sleeps behind our psychological fear of the darkness." And I think that there's so much of that in regards to what you're referencing right now,
mm-hmm.
like the psychological, whether we realize it or not, that memory, the cellular memory, I am not even aware of where did all these, even just anxiety, you know, often in the mornings I'll joke about myself because I can't joke about other people that are online. So I have to joke around. I make myself the joke. You know, but anxiety, you know, my family will say, oh, well, you know, anxiety is a part of our family. It's like in our DNA. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that, but I also know that there is these opportunities of curiosity and discomfort that I've had to look for that could help, you know, pull that thread that's tied so tight to anxiety from my generation before us, that I could let go of some of that anxiety or work it, knead it out, untie it a little bit. But that's the one like generational condition that I can really pinpoint as part of my life's work.
Mm.
And then I realized through our conversations, which is part of conversation is so powerful. I think I just want to reference something because I won't forget my thought, which is part of, I think, the reason I took so much solace in your work is because of how well you hold the space to have race and ethnic conversations with white people and black people and brown people of every color that exist on this planet, and holding that with so much compassion, even in your writing. I think that that was probably why I took shelter under your books for a long time. And so when I think about the conversations that, yes, maybe a lot of people are having aren't helpful, but how we have conversation and how important conversation is, even in yoga, I'll talk and teach about connecting as conversation, even in the physical space. Like, if you just ignore the people next to you, that doesn't help you as a person learn about yourself. That doesn't help you confront your own feelings of, I don't want to talk to this person. They don't look like me, or they might not know me. They might not like me. As an adult, that's really difficult for us to look at. in that way. Mm-hmm. But when we have conversations like this around race and ethnicity, what I have found through you is that my self-reflection practice, like I did this morning, has helped me confront this idea of my own privilege, my own experience of being white, my own experience of being Jewish and being ashamed that I was Jewish my whole life going to Cranbrook. And there was no Jewish people at Cranbrook when I was there. Now there are more Jewish people at Cranbrook. But it was a very, like, I started thinking recently while reading your book, like, why did I always want to be Christian? Like, I always wanted to be Christian. I always wanted to celebrate Christmas. It's like, oh, well, if I really look at why, it's not just because Christmas is more fun. It's because I wanted to fit in as, like, you know, I wanted to fit in. I wanted my hair straight instead of curly. So I read all of your book, and I think when you say self-study, I think, which is what you and I really want to talk about, which is what we're talking about now, but, like, how is a person, a white person, how do I continue to look at how race has affected me? Which is part of the conversation that you bring up in your book, that you're helping pose these questions. And I think that how you do that and you pose questions is more curious than confronting.
Oh, yeah.
And that, right? And that can help us, not us, us, everybody, not us, white people, black people, brown people, like everyone start humans, to look right. at mm-hmm. humans. What has happened to us and how for many years and decades? And yeah. So I don't know if I have a question about it. I think it's really about the power of, maybe the topic is communities of care in your book, and how much acceptance is required, how much compassion is required as we individually do work on our own exploration of race and ethnicity, as well as being in community with other people while we do it.
So self-compassion, it's funny because on Thursday I'm doing a webinar for an organization, and it's called
it's okay.
When it's these long, you know, and we do these long things here. Self-compassion, or compassionate self-study. It goes on to talk about race-based stress and trauma. I can't remember that, you know.
Right.
Everything. But anyway, that's not important. But we have to, when we go into this exploration, all right, look. None of us, you can't see your face unless you have a mirror to look in, right?
Right.
Right now. I mean, we can see our faces now because we're on this computer and there we are. But if you don't have that, you cannot see your face if you're just all by yourself alone in a room. So it's important for us to learn to go within ourselves and to face that darkness that Bynum talks about, which when you go deep enough into the darkness, see, just because you close your eyes and it's dark doesn't mean there's nothing there. It just means you haven't stayed in there long enough to be able to see what's mm-hmm. coming up, what's available. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So our meditation practices take us into that space of darkness, and out of that can come deep wisdom. All right. And we mm-hmm. can begin to see with more clarity. But we also need each other to hold up mirrors for each other. So that's what you and I have done for each other. You've said that you have learned some things from me that sometimes the conversations have been, I don't know, have they been hard?
Yeah.
Oh, have they? Okay.
Not between us. Yeah. No, not between us.
Yeah.
Not in our relationship. You know, I think you and I mentioned this before, but there were some very difficult conversations that I personally had and relationships that broke.
Yeah.
And that was probably the most painful one in particular, was the hardest, and it still is broken.
Yeah.
That person has exiled me from their life, and I haven't talked to them really since. And it was about race and their own inability to process their own experience with race, as well as, you know, my own ignorance at the time, for sure.
Yeah.
And the combination of those two were just maybe too confronting for that person. And I still think about this relationship all the time. And the break of it was race and racism and what has happened in our country, and not because of any reason other than our wounds are so painful.
Yes. That's, yeah, well, there you go. And so that's why it's hard to have the conversation. So one of the things I love about your work is that you are willing personally to confront your own pain and suffering. And I know, you know, some of your personal background, and why you are so invested in emotional and psychological health and well-being.
Mm-hmm.
But unless and until you confront, one confronts one's own pain and suffering, one cannot relate to somebody else's. Because what you're mm-hmm. going to do, if you haven't dealt with your own stuff, is deflect. You're going to minimize, you're going to try and fix, you're going to ignore, you're going to have a fight with somebody. You see what I'm saying? So yeah. You have really done a lot of the inner work, whether you meant to do it or not, you know, whether or not you were forced yeah. to do it or not. And so you're willing and able to go there. You know, and so therefore you can teach other people how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, the number one lesson of teacher training that I tell people, which is what I have learned through many different ways, like superficially, you can't teach asana to a depth unless you've met that depth. You can't teach psychological concepts until you have gone to those depths. You can't. And so, yes, it's so true at every single level, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. While we talk, just to acknowledge it, while you and I have conversations around race and ethnicity, I always have a cellular response to it. Like my body is not relaxed, mm-hmm. even though I'm psychologically relaxed with mm-hmm. you. Anytime I go into conversations around race and ethnicity, my body has a completely different reaction mm-hmm. than my mind is having or my mm-hmm. intellect is having.
Tell me, I mean, again, so you're being very open, and so this.
Oh yeah,
fun for
I'm
you.
Always.
So, what's what is it? I mean, what happens in your body, and what happens in?
In my body, I feel like more anxious. I'll feel more anxious, or like right now, physically, I'm much colder than I tip. I mean, I get cold. That's true, but I tend to get more cold as if I'm like doing a public talk, which when you're doing a public. I know we're doing a public talk, but I don't process this as a public talk anymore. So like, that's not helpful to people. But if I was doing a public talk, I was nervous to do.
Yeah.
This is how my body would respond, but I'm not nervous to have a conversation with you. It's only when we start talking about race and ethnicity that then my body has a reaction that is sort of atypical for what I typically experience. And my mind is not uncomfortable having these conversations. It's like my body has a completely different reaction.
Mm-hmm.
So I always explore that. I'm not uncomfortable about having that. And I'm not nervous. It's more just like an acceptance. Like, okay, my body is going to process this experience in some ways differently than my mind is, which then gives me a more understanding of myself. But I don't know where that comes from. Like, actually, I do think it comes from some of those painful conversations I've had around race and ethnicity and the actual trauma that happened. Okay, now we can really talk about it. But the actual trauma that happened when I had those conversations, it was traumatizing. And I'll be honest with you and all the people listening, as I'm like physically now shaking about it, having conversations with people who didn't have compassion, who were in their own wounds at a time that we were all open wounded and walking around with wounds everywhere. It was traumatizing, like actually. And I think I should go to therapy about it now that we're having this conversation. I'm like, I should actually go back to therapy, which thank you, Dr. Parker, for your efforts today to bringing me into therapy. But it was,
You started it.
I did start it. And I actually am not uncomfortable talking about it because it's important for me. I think it's important to demonstrate vulnerability in the same way you write your book. I do a podcast. I teach trainings. I'm not afraid of my own vulnerabilities. I think this one is a very hard one for me to reconcile because I was very hurt.
Well, that answers the question that you asked me originally. Why did I not want to make myself vulnerable in this arena? Because belonging is a human need. We all have a need to belong. It's more than a desire. We have a need to belong. We are social beings. And rejection is one of the most painful, emotionally painful experiences a human can have. And it literally hurts in the body. It's not just, it's not just, again, a cognitive experience. You're describing what happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get a stomach ache. Your heart starts beating faster or it even hurts. You get a headache. You know, all these various physical symptoms occur, which is what tells us, wait a minute, there's something going on here. And so none of us likes to feel rejected. So mm-hmm. I know that every time I have this conversation, especially with people I don't know,
yeah,
I could face rejection and I don't like it. It hurts every single time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but I don't let that keep me from doing it.
Yeah.
Like you.
Right.
We call that courage. Mm-hmm. That's what I call it. I call it courage. When you're willing to step into that place that we might call fear, and do it anyway. But it was interesting because I was at Citizen Yoga when this happened. I was, I don't know if I was in Bloomfield Hills or Royal Oak, but I was minding my own business in Shavasana one day. I was.
I'm so glad you weren't minding everybody else in Shavasana.
I was minding my own business. You know, I'm just there. I'm in it. I was in, you know how you're not always in Shavasana?
Totally.
I was in it.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah, it was great. And I too had been someone just kind of filled with anxiety through all my life, but I didn't let it keep me from doing the things that I needed to do. But what I did with my fear, my anxiety, was what most people do. I kept trying to get over it. I kept trying to let it go. I kept trying not to feel it, you know, doing all the things that we do.
Yes.
Well, as we all know, this does not work. It doesn't work.
Because public service announcement,
yeah, you know
that
I mean?
Does not work.
It doesn't work. But you keep trying it anyway, because maybe
sometime
it'll work.
Right. Yeah.
I'm minding my own business in Shavasana. This is after many, many years of yoga and yoga philosophy and therapy myself and et cetera. All of a sudden, this feeling swept through me. And it took about that long. And I remember, I thought, oh, that's what fear feels like.
Interesting.
I've never felt it since. Now we do learn that when this stuff manages, this energy that we have trapped within ourselves, because why? We contracted around it was painful, we couldn't process it for whatever reason, so it just stays and stays and stays, and we keep pushing it down, trying not to feel it, trying to avoid it, trying to get over it for years. It's chronic, it's what we do. And some kind of way it escaped that day. It escaped. My defenses were down. This thing came through. I'm telling you, I have not had a moment of anxiety since, and that was years ago.
That's amazing.
I was so shocked. I thought, oh, that's what fear feels like. And then it was gone. It released. The energy released.
Wow.
That's what our practices do for us.
Yes.
Now, it does. Does it happen every time? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
But when for some reason you are in that state of deep, it was beyond relaxation. I was just in a deep state of awareness.
Yeah.
And boom, there it was. It left. And it's just an amazing.
That's amazing.
It's pretty amazing. So thank you, Citizen Yoga.
Oh yeah, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
You know, it's I found that this year I was telling Adam this, and actually a few of my friends, that you know, having Penelope has given me, it reorganized my value system in a way that I don't know if it happens to everybody, but I hope it does, where there's just like a complete joy all the time. Yep. That's like the realization that time is going and that life is precious has reorganized. I always knew through Vedanta and through philosophy and through all of our yoga that like this is temporary. But I think like having a physical representation of time come into my life and cherish something in a way that's completely different than just Citizen Yoga, which Citizen really has helped me with my anxiety as well in a completely different way. But I still have anxiety, but it's completely different, where my level of want is different now. My need to acquire is so much calmer. Mm-hmm. And that I know it's like something happened that kind of changed. I've had some of those changes in my life where like it seems like an instant, though we know both know it's not an instant. It's so many years of work that happens. And then it feels like an instant of something occurring, but it's an amazing experience to have that release. Mm-hmm. And I do think our practices and our reflections, self-reflection specifically, which is part of what we're talking about. Like what's asana without self-reflection?
Exercise.
Yeah. Exercise. Yeah. And so it's interesting to hear your, I haven't ever heard somebody else talk about those kinds of instant feelings where you've transformed. I've had two of them in my life, very intense ones. One's personal that I don't share publicly. One is having Penelope. And it's an amazing experience to be more free. And I don't know if that's the right word.
Yeah, I think it is. But I just want to back up a little bit and just say to people who are listening, it's not that I don't feel fear anymore. I do. Now I know what fear feels like. See, anxiety comes from suppressing your fear, your fears, your fear. That's what it is. It's not
right.
A thing. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's the result of ongoing, of not wanting to feel what you're feeling.
Yeah.
And I would say the same is probably true of some depression. It's not, you know, it's not wanting to feel what you're feeling, because that's all I had to say. Yeah.
There's the example you gave in the book of the dog laying on the nail.
Yes, I was just going to go there.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yep. That's what okay, I well, to say.
Really? Come on.
For real.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. It's one of my favorite examples of the book.
It. You want to share it or?
Yeah. I'll share it. Let me, I marked the page. Okay. I did admit while I find this page, I did admit to Dr. Parker that in her book, it like won't let me on my Kindle, like copy and share something anymore, because I've copied and shared so many pages and thinks I'm trying to steal her book. Which is always really, really funny. Okay. I'm actually going to read the majority of it. Is that okay?
Yeah.
I'll read the whole paragraph. Okay.
Yeah, I think it's important.
Okay. There's a story Dr. Parker likes to share about the cost of ignoring our emotional wounds. A dog is laying on the ground next to his owner, whimpering. A passerby asks, "What's wrong with your dog?" The owner says, "He's lying on a nail." The passerby asks, "Well, why doesn't he get up?" The owner says, "Because that hurts even more." I'm going to continue. If you've ever stepped on a sharp object, you know that in order for healing to occur, you have to extract it. Sometimes that hurts more than stepping on it. So it is understandable that you might resist pulling it out, but leaving it in is never helpful and does more harm than good. Even though removing the object may hurt more than stepping on it did, the pain of removal is temporary, whereas tolerating or ignoring pain retards the healing process and makes matters worse. This is true of both physical and emotional pain. In order to heal, the dog has to get off the nail, even though that hurts more than lying on it does. In order for us to heal as it pertains to race and ethnicity, each of us needs to get up off the nail of our own combativeness, defensiveness, hypervigilance, and fragility. If we don't, healing cannot occur, and we risk becoming blind, numb, indifferent, and even cruel in the face of our own and others' pain and suffering. Amazing. Mm-hmm. Do you want me to continue?
It's up to you.
That was everything I had highlighted.
Okay.
The one thing that I will jump down just one more. There's a few more sentences where it says individuals with strong emotional support are more resilient. Oh, okay. Let me just give a little context to your own book. I'm going to give context to Dr. Parker's book. But I will say that the example of the nail, let's just go there because then the rest of the next paragraph is amazing. Why did you choose that? And obviously people can understand what you're saying because I read the summary of why you put it in there. But can you elaborate in any way, shape, or form? Or do you want to add anything to that story or that section of the book?
I just think it's a good way to illustrate that, you know, it's normal and natural to contract around our pain.
Yeah.
Because it hurt, you know, it hurts. So we, you know, ouch. So that's our big ouch. If we stay in the pain, if we stay on the nail, if we remain in contraction around a painful experience, an emotionally painful experience, it gets worse. It doesn't change. So if I, for whatever reason, contracted around fear and stayed on and stayed in that contracted, that emotionally contracted state without knowing it, I'm not, you know, it wasn't deliberate. Over the years, that becomes anxiety. Mm-hmm. And it pops up in very inconvenient ways at very inconvenient times. And then you have to force yourself, someone like me forces herself to do whatever it is I have to do anyway, but it doesn't change the contracted state. I'm just now adding more stress to myself. Yeah. When you are laying in Shavasana, minding your own business, and this feeling swoops up and over you, and you think, oh, that's what I've been afraid of. That's what I have been trying not to feel all my life.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Fear can be very, I still don't like it. It's not my favorite. But right. It's useful.
Yes.
To know, you know, when there's something stirring in you that causes fear. What you then have mm-hmm. to figure out, though, is it an external threat or an internal memory?
Yes.
Trigger or an internal association that I'm making. Mm-hmm. Now, that's, again, where discernment comes in. But again, I say that our practices help us cultivate our mind as a new awareness so that we can at least ask the question. The mm-hmm. young men who were arrested in Starbucks, remember a couple years ago?
Yep.
I postulate that the store manager was having an internal experience because they were not doing anything threatening to her. They were just right. young black men sitting in a predominantly white environment, and I guess she didn't feel like they belonged there or whatever association she was making
right.
with their gender, their race. But they weren't doing anything. Mm-hmm. So it's important for us to begin to at least ask the question, what, like you did, wait a minute, all they said is, how come
do you have childcare?
That's all they said.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm, you know, and like I'm spiraling down into this tunnel of angst.
I'm going to fail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Why
did I fail?
Yeah.
Well, there's this concept in philosophy we'll talk about often called neutralization, which my teacher Swamiji, he talked a lot about, which is the more you contact an object, the less joy you get from it. But when you contact an object so much, you no longer get joy. But if you don't have it, you receive pain. And I watch, I've had this own experience in myself, but also, you know, I'm talking to a friend who's going through recovery right now, eating recovery, actually. And, you know, they're so afraid of, well, what do I have without this thing? Like, is it going to be nothing? Mm-hmm. So like the pain of the addiction is very painful. But the fear of getting off the nail is so, has been for many decades so intense that they avoided getting off the nail. And now they're off the nail and they're like, oh my God.
Now what?
Life. Okay, this isn't as scary as I thought. This is, you know, but even just getting off the nail, like, was so, it's scary. Like, am I going to be nothing? What am I going to fill my time with? Am I going to belong anywhere? Am I going to be lonely?
I was going to say, I think it's the fear of nothing that is really the fundamental, the abhinivesha, the fear, we call it the fear of death, but it's really the fear of annihilation, of non-existence, you know?
Yes.
And that's why we fear the darkness, because we experience that as nothing. And the truth of the matter is, it isn't nothing. It's something. But you have to stay in it long enough to get to the something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
Somebody once said to me, how did it go? People would rather stay in a familiar hell than to risk experiencing a lifetime of joy.
Yes.
I think that's true.
Yes. I think so, too.
Sometimes, yeah. That it's familiar. I know it. We adapt, in other words.
Yeah.
And that's part of we adapt to these stresses. We adapt to the normalization of behaviors that are just not healthy, not acceptable,
yes.
Not good. Yeah.
Yes.
But we adapt and we make the adjustments. And I would say that I think that's what my work is about. It's supporting people in recognizing that, yeah, these adaptive responses, for example, I'm so glad you brought yourself up.
Yeah, go ahead. Please. Okay.
So if there's this lineage of anxiety in the family, you know, this ancestral anxiety. I mean, if anybody knows anything at all about Jewish history, it sort of makes sense. You know what I mean? That this may be a part of the part of the DNA that we're carrying. All right. And so, I forgot what I was going to say. I was going to be good too.
No, that's okay. You were saying there's adaptive ways of
yeah,
living.
Yeah. So you adapt to it. So you adapt to, I don't know. You try to adapt to a culture that may be hostile toward you.
Yes.
That creates anxiety.
Yes.
That is not a safe place to be.
Mm-hmm.
To adapt to a culture that is potentially threatening and hostile to you. That's a lot of work. That's what you said you did in high school. That's what I've had to do. You know, you adapt to a culture that could be hostile and threatening toward you. So that's always there until you start reaching a point, until you call on that courage, because that's in us too. It's not just the anxiety.
Right.
When courage becomes more profound, when that energy of courage is more powerful than the fear,
mm-hmm.
when you come into that heart space and strengthen that, that's where we want to be.
And one of the, this is perfect segue, because I'm going to read the next paragraph or so, which people listening, or maybe some people listening, have never met me. So, but community to me is the most important thing. I know that sounds like the craziest thing to say. Like, what's the most important thing that you think happens in this world? And I think community is the most important thing that happens in this world, besides, of course, like personal study. But Community is profound. So here, this is, I am after the section, it's page 79 in my Kindle, but that's not always accurate to the book. So just so people know, here, Dr. Parker says, resilience in the face of ethnic and race-based stress and trauma is critical, critical to physical and emotional health and well-being. Resilience is the capacity to recover quickly and bounce back from ongoing cumulative and recurrent stress before it becomes chronic or traumatic, or before you burn out. Individuals with strong emotional support are more resilient in the face of stress and social exclusion than those who experience the isolation of social exclusion without support. Rather than eliciting the fight or flight response, relational connection elicits the tend and befriend response. To tend and befriend is to reach out to others for comfort when you are in distress rather than fight, avoid, or withdraw. Reaching out to others in times of distress has a calming effect, and there is a biomechanical reason for this. When we are in a positive connection with others, oxytocin, a neurochemical associated with empathy, love, and relationship building, is active in the body, sending internal signals that reduce fight or flight or the withdrawal shutdown response. And when we look at the work that's required, something that I admire that you've done is, regardless of race, ethnicity, you've offered conversations to everyone. And that has created, like, I remember when the resurgence of Black Lives Matter happened, I really found this book to be my friend. That was very important for me personally, as somebody who really wanted to change and be better and do the work, but was scared also to do the work, and also having a traumatic experience. And as we all have all those things, when big things in our society shifts and changes. But I found that this book became my friend. And I mean, you're also thankfully my friend, but, and teacher, but it did something to my nervous system. And now to say, I think other humans, if you're listening, like, I've been through social exclusion. I'm sure you have been through feeling socially excluded. It's painful. It's what you and I are talking about. I want to do a podcast on, like, what does it feel like when you lose a friend? Because so many people are okay with the grief of a death or the grief of a divorce. But what does it feel like when friendships break up? Like, those are just as painful as anything that we experience as human beings. And so I just don't want us to underestimate the power of being in relationship as we try to heal together.
Exactly. I mean, it's essential. So, you know, we hear a lot about self-care, but, and self-care is an important thing, but we also need to feel taken care of. So in community, we take care of self and we take care of each other.
Can I borrow your you for a little bit longer?
Okay. I have to be, we have
okay,
to be
what time
before 11:30. Okay.
She's on Pacific
whatever
time.
Yeah. What are you? 1:30? 2:30? I don't know.
Yeah, two. I wanted to find, there's a part of your book. There's two, I tend to go deep into chapter 6, which is communities of care, in chapter 7. Again, this is not like a book review. No, I would take it as a book review for Dr. Parker. But I think that there's, in communities of care, there's two last questions I want to ask. I'm going to quote, it's chapter 6, it's at the beginning. When you live in a culture that emphasizes autonomy and independence over interdependence, you can lose sight of the fact that you are wired to live in connection with others. I don't need to say anything more. I think that like summarizes the entire chapter in like the best way ever. But I find that when we're talking about race and ethnicity, it's it sometimes feels, and I could be wrong. This is where I feel vulnerable saying, am I going to say the wrong thing? Okay. It feels very scary to have conversations and be wrong about race and ethnicity. And it feels like you're only allowed to have conversations with, I can only have real conversations with other white people, or, you know, I don't always think that we create, which we are at Citizen. I'm very grateful for that. We are really working hard to create a genuinely more inclusive community, through the help of you and many others. But, phrase my question? I'm hiding from my question, which is, I feel like, how do we create communities of care that look different? How do we continue to have conversations that are authentic about inclusion? Because it's more complex than just representation. It's more complex than just posting interesting photos on social media. That was like one of the calls to action for Citizen. Well, you need to have more people who look different on your social media. And I was like, if that was the answer, then I'm like, that's great. But that's bullshit, because that's not who is in our studio. We need to change the studio. We need to change the yoga industry. Mm-hmm. So what is your advice on how do we approach these conversations, I guess is my question, which I think you have a little different of a take. I don't know. That's very roundabout.
That's okay.
Apologize, listeners, for my terrible question asking to Dr. Parker.
That's good. But you see, these questions that you're asking, you know, one of the things I say to people when they ask me a question is I say, well, tell me what you know about the answer to that question. So the one that you asked me originally, well, how come you were so, what were you vulnerable about writing about this stuff? Same thing you're vulnerable about. You know, I don't want to
get left around. Yeah, totally.
Here's the thing. You can either be right or you can be in relationship.
Oh, I love you. Thank you. What an amazing answer.
We all make mistakes.
Yeah.
I make mistakes. And when you do, it's important to realize I have made a mistake and to find a way to make amends, not to ask for forgiveness. Don't do that. It is not okay to hurt somebody and then ask the person you hurt, even whether you meant to hurt them or not, to forgive you. Don't do that. You know, I write about that in my second book, The Transforming Ethnic and Race-Based Stress and Trauma through Yoga. So how do I make amends? How do I make up for what I did? Well, each individual, there's not a formula for that. But I leave you with the contemplation. If I've stepped on, I'll give you an example.
Okay.
It's a personal example, and it was very embarrassing for me. I was invited to be a guest in someone's yoga teacher training, yoga therapy training, and it was a predominantly white group. There were maybe a handful of a couple of South Asian American women who were South Asian ancestry, couple of African-American men, and that was about the extent of, and me, the racial mix. And issues of race came up. Issues of cultural appropriation came up, that's what it was. And one of the participants said something, I don't understand why we have to talk about race, and that's what it was. I don't understand why we have to have this conversation. I got triggered. I didn't say anything, I just sat there, but it was very annoying to me, and it was not managed. You know what I'm saying? It was like ignored or something like that. And in my frustration, I confided in one of the other participants what I thought about that. Well, what came back to haunt me was the person I confided in, who I thought I
confided
in, told the you know, the host of the program, and who I think she sat on it for about 6 or 8 months. Okay. And we were in conversation about something else. She said, there's something I need to ask you. So-and-so said that you said a few things that really were upsetting to her, because I was mad, you know.
Yeah.
And she said, did you say that? I said, you know what, I don't remember saying that. I was like 8 months later or six, you know. I said, but it's possible that I did. Tell me more. So she did. She said, well, maybe she made it up. I said, there's no reason for anyone to have made up.
Yeah.
What you have just shared, because I was using profanity. I mean, she quoted the profanity that I used.
I like this.
I was so embarrassed. Do you know how embarrassed I was? But I may have said something like that. I've said, you know, no, I didn't. I said, you know what, she could not possibly have made that up. I don't remember it, but I doubt that she made it up. And I apologize to you because I overstepped by da-da-da-da, something like that. So I don't know whether or not that repaired anything.
Yeah.
But, oh, I was so embarrassed. But I will tell you this. I was talking to another friend about it, who's a psychotherapist, she said, that brought something up in you. You were remembering a past hurt.
Yes.
That you didn't know about. And so it was very helpful to me to figure out, you know, she's right. She said, don't be mad at yourself for doing that, because you need to recognize that for some reason that encounter had meaning for you. So I would say that to everybody, that, you know, whatever is happening has meaning. But you have to dig deep enough within yourself to understand what does this mean to me?
Yeah.
What happened? How come I got so upset? It was one of those, you know, why did I get so upset? Because somebody said, I don't think we should have to talk about race. Of all the,
right.
You know what I'm saying? It's that.
Yes. Yes.
That is not a neutral statement for me. So,
yeah.
But I also lost my cool. It wasn't.
Right.
So,
yes.
So you have to pay attention to that and own it.
One of the this will be my last question for today, which is one of the things you had listed out is that it's complicated to address race because it's an internal and an there's both internal. I don't want to use the word trigger because that's not actually the word you used. I just can't remember where I would reference it from. And then there's an external trigger and there's an internal trigger that happens, and how you distinguish which one is which. This is part of what makes, you know, race complicated to heal. It makes race complicated to handle for people. And so how can you, I guess my question is, can you describe that a little bit more? Can you clarify that a little bit more of like, why is it so complicated to heal.
An example. What I say is that we have got, meaning anyone who cares to do the work. That's who I'm talking about, is we.
Yes.
The people who don't care to do the work, I'm not talking to them. If you want to live a conscious life, you want to, it's not up to you to make other people conscious. It's up to you to be conscious of your own self, your own internal experience and your external experience. That's our work. Mm-hmm. So if you want to live a conscious life, you want to understand. So when I got triggered in this yoga teacher training, there was nobody threatening me. That was all that was all me.
Right.
But I was acting as if I had been offended. As if I had been threatened. Well, I was offended, but I was actually, I was.
Yeah.
But instead of owning that and doing a little self-examination, I have to cough. So can I
cough? Myself? Yeah, mute, cough away, or just.
Excuse me, everyone.
Oh, that's fine. Just do what you need to do.
I couldn't. I don't know where the mute.
Let me see. Oh, I could have muted you, maybe. Okay, go. Cough. We're gonna give her some free cough time. Okay. I also have a cold, so I think it's just the season.
And dehydrate.
Okay, she's back. Okay.
What kept me in that moment from doing a little self-reflection? Because I got hijacked by my emotions.
Yes.
And so I came out of myself and got caught up in being angry with the person who said something that offended me. So, again, and I, you know, it was interesting. It was really a gift when the remember I said we all need mirrors?
Yes.
Can't see ourselves. If she had not shared that with me, I wish she had shared it with me sooner, but she couldn't because she's like you. I'm afraid I'll say something wrong. I don't want to say anything wrong, you know.
Yeah.
But when we hold a mirror up for each other, we have to be willing. Are you willing to hear what people are saying to you? You have to be willing to hear and receiving what, because they're seeing something in you that you may not be able to see in yourself. And we can all grow from all of that.
Yes.
So we learn the difference between an internal reaction and an external threat through experience and through observation, self-observation.
Yeah. And so then there are spaces, like, so for Citizen, you know, how do spaces make themselves less of an external threat?
The spaces don't, the human beings who are
right.
occupying the space too.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
you know, you
very have, true.
Well, it's true. You want to create a safe space, you have to create a space that's friendly,
mm-hmm.
warm, and welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
You know how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know how to do that. You do know how to do
yeah.
that.
Yes.
And so that's what we're trying to do. You know, we look, first of all, we live in segregated communities. That's not
yes.
your fault.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's this is very complex. So you also have to be willing to deal with complexity here. There are no simple solutions to any of this.
Mm-hmm.
But when you use imagery that is inviting to everyone, you know, when you are welcoming, when you are friendly, it's just being decent to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And what else can you do?
Mm-hmm. I think that I had to become aware much more, like, actively conscious that people have a lot of different wounding than what I can see.
Yes.
I think that was a big learning for me. I can't understand what it's like to be somebody that doesn't fit into the yoga world.
But
I grew up in it. I was 10.
But you can understand what it's like to be someone who doesn't fit in. Cranbrook.
Correct.
That's
yes.
all I'm saying. We call on those experiences. You do know what it's
yes.
like not to fit in. You know what it
yes.
feels like. It's horrible.
No. Totally. I just think that was like, I think so. Yes. And we don't have time to keep going on this
yeah.
topic, but I do think that there is a vigilance that I had to bring in to become more aware. Yes, I was always friendly. Yes, I was always welcoming because of my experience with mental health and social isolation and bullying and all those things. But it really wasn't until my own decision to become aware of race
yes.
did I realize how much people were carrying. That, I think, is that was a change, and it didn't change my behavior. It did change my behavior. It changed that the behavior had to be even more conscious.
That's exactly right. It does. And part of the consciousness of the behavior, if you're white and you're inviting Black people and brown people, non-white people into your spaces,
yes.
they see you as white. That's what
yes.
they're seeing. And,
right.
and with that comes a caution.
Yes.
There's, you know, you're under a different kind of scrutiny. Am
mm-hmm.
I, and the scrutiny is this, am I in a safe space?
Right.
Can I be welcomed here? So it's that awareness that people coming into your space, but the truth of that, I mean, you have some teachers there, I know them, who do that. I don't know how they just do that. They are welcome. It doesn't matter who comes in. You feel welcomed. You feel acknowledged. You feel safe.
Yeah. But it's for people, you know, I'm sure studio owners are listening and, you know, anyways, okay, we have to pause.
Words, if you want to make a safe space for other people, we do have to go. You have to show up as safe. And that means you have to do your inner work. You have to do some deep dive, some deep excavation and find out, what is my energy body communicating here? Have I learned to be afraid of black people? If you live in America, yes, you have.
Yes.
So, what
or men, or, yeah,
what's
who is it?
The excavation I have to do here?
Yes.
So that I can come clean with myself and not be projecting my stuff onto other people. Because you're the teacher, you're the owner. The students don't have to do that. I mean, we would like them to learn to do that. So we're teaching everybody to try not to do that. But you're the owner, you're the teacher, you have to do that work. And then you create an environment.
An environment
that allows people to do the same, which is to be self-reflective, to know the difference between a threat and an internal memory that's cropping up.
So
I wish you could keep going.
Thank you. No, thank you so much. So for everybody who's listening, and if you're listening past May 9th of 2023, then it's irrelevant in this moment to you. But Dr. Parker is joining us for a private workshop. It will be online, so you can tune in from anywhere. May 9th in the evening. I think it's 5:30 Eastern Standard Time. Okay, I don't have it in front of me, which is the worst thing I could ever do, but that is hysterical. It is in the evenings. I do believe it's 5:30 till 8:30. So, and there's going to be a Q&A, but we're going to work through the topic of self-study and the importance of self-study as it relates to race and ethnicity. Dr. Parker is going to teach a guest class on our retreat, which I'm very excited about at 2Bunch. And that'll be on gut health, the relationship of gut health and restorative yoga and your nervous system. You can find Dr. Parker at Dr. Gail Parker. It's G-A-I-L. That could be confusing. And thank you so much being a teacher and a friend. And I hope that everyone listening found this to be insightful. And again, please go purchase her books. They really, really will help you, even if you don't practice yoga.
It's true.
If you're just going to read it to help and hear a compassionate perspective on approaching your own race and ethnicity, that is why you would purchase this book.
And really your own humanity.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. So
thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.